Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. My guest today is this year's Brock International Prize winner in education, Professor Gloria Ladson Billings of the University of Wisconsin. Professor Ladson Billings is the Kellner Family Chair in Urban Education there and is known for her groundbreaking work in culturally relevant teaching and critical race theory. Her research is focused on the pedagogical practices of teachers who are successful with African-American students. She's written scores of articles and three books on this topic, including The Dream Keepers, Successful Teachers of African-American Children, Crossing Over to Canaan, The Journey of New Teachers in Diverse Classrooms, and Beyond the Big House, African-American Educators on Teacher Education. In recent years, she has attacked the usage of the term at-risk and achievement gap for its stigmatic effects. She says we should think of the educational disparities between whites and people of color as the educational debt, reflecting a failure on society. Not only educational disparities, but also disparities in funding between urban and suburban schools, healthcare, and personal wealth. She'll be delivering the keynote address at the Brock Symposium on Excellence in Education this Thursday at 4:30 at the University of Tulsa's Lorton Performance Center. She joins us today by phone here on Studio Tulsa. Professor Ladson Billings, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Well, it's my pleasure.
We hear so much talk about the achievement gap, and I know when you were president of the American Educational Research Association, and in speeches since then, you say it's more appropriately our educational debt.
Yes.
Talk about this distinction, if you will.
Well, I've tried to get people to understand that when we speak about it as a gap, we are almost always putting the responsibility on the students alone. Sometimes we put it on their parents, or sometimes we put it on individual teachers. But when we start talking about debt, because right now, when we look at the sort of our national scene and the economy, we all feel some responsibility for debt. It kind of came to me after being stuck in a cab near the Triborough Bridge in New York on my way to the airport. And there's a big sign that has these flashing numbers, and the numbers are turning over quickly, and it says, this is the national debt. And it's just a huge number, as you know. And then right underneath, there's another set of flashing numbers, not quite as big, but it's still a big number, and it says, and this is your family's share. And all I could think of is, oh my goodness, well, I can't pay that kind. But the question for me was, why did I feel like I was supposed to? Because it was framed as a debt. It wasn't like, this is the gap between how much money we have and how much we need, you know. I think it was framed that way, I'd probably think, well, then, you know, you guys look like you're in trouble. But by pointing out that I, too, shared in this, it really helped me to think about, wow, that's sort of what's happening in education. We can't just say there's a group of kids that it's their responsibility to catch up, and they need to do this, and they need to do that. But what is it that we have done over time to create this circumstance? And so I've tried to look at it historically. I've tried to look at it economically. I've tried to look at it politically. And finally, I've tried to look at it morally.
Do you feel like there is a feeling in the affluent classes, the higher socioeconomic groups, that this really isn't their problem?
It is, and it's at their own peril. Because if we don't educate more students and do a better job of it, then those who think their finances are safe will be in some ways taxed even more. And what I mean by that is it costs money to put people in prison. It costs money to pay for social welfare. It costs money to, you know, when someone comes into an emergency room without adequate health care, the doctor is still going to get paid. Now, where that money comes from is those of us who actually pay for health care, pay higher premiums. It's, you know, it's like the old, the thing with the car insurance. You know, people get soaked because somebody hits you without insurance. And you think, well, my insurance will cover it. Well, they will, but the next time around, your premiums are higher. So to try to help people understand the way in which these things are all intertwined.
You've also, you mentioned several times that in educational circles, we like to talk about the achievement gap, but we don't talk about the other gaps. For example,
right.
The disparity in support for suburban versus urban schools.
Right. The actual per pupil expenditures are, the disparity there is just outrageous. I mean, an average of about $10,000 difference in what we're spending when we know, for example, the needs are greater. And I think the hard conversation will be to have people understand that actually giving the same amount of money is not going to do it, you know, because I think a lot of times we'd like to think of equality as sameness or equity as sameness. Mm-hmm. What will happen, you know, I give very crude analogies because I'm a simple-minded person, but, you know, if you live in a tenement house, you know, that's kind of falling down, and I live in a beautiful suburban house, and you give us both $1,000, you may have to use your $1,000 to fix your hot water heater. You know, you really need hot water. Okay, you've done that, but nobody can see the difference. I, on the other hand, could probably buy patio furniture. Uh-huh. And if someone rode by my house, they would say, oh, look how well those people, you know, keep their house up. And look at that lovely patio furniture. Like I said, it's a crude analogy, but if you've been sort of starving out of system for a very long time, just equalizing the funding isn't going to give you the same sort of bang for your buck, because once again, there's that debt that's been accumulated over time. And so that there's so much infrastructure that has to be built in many of these school districts that it's gonna take a while.
Well, you talk about the semantic element of changing that idea of the achievement gap to the educational debt, as well as the actual what it means in the school teaching to that. Can you maybe talk about those differences?
Well, I think we still maintain some language that keeps us thinking about depravity or deficit, even though we would never say that in polite company anymore. You know, we always say, oh, no, everybody has a rich culture. But we say some things like, these people don't care about education. Or we say things like, these children aren't ready for school. That one kind of gets me because, you know, when you're five, you should be just like every other five-year-old in some ways. I mean, you don't come with a big resume to kindergarten. You shouldn't, you know. And if you have one, it shouldn't matter. I always say, you know, whatever happened to being 5 years old and being able to make it to the bathroom 3 out of 5 times? And I don't demand 5 out of 5 because people in my generation don't make it 5 out of 5. You know, the truth of the matter, they sell depends for a reason. You know? So I'm being somewhat facetious, but I'm saying we are probably placing some very unrealistic timelines, developmental timelines, on what kids should or could do at the age of 5. And when you look at our international partners, people in Scandinavia, for example, they typically don't send their kids to school till they're about 7. And they're not behind us in any international comparison. So we might be expecting way too much for kids to do at 5 years old. The other thing I think is been kind of a real pet peeve of mine is this conversation of the culture of poverty. I was trained in anthropology, and all the anthropology that I studied at Stanford, I never studied anything called the culture of poverty. Because poverty really isn't a culture. It's a set of social arrangements, something that reflects the values of a society. And indeed, if poverty is a culture, that means 75% of the world is in that culture. And so they would be the dominant culture.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I'm frustrated by that kind of framing of the debate because what comes out of that is, well, you know, really all we can do with these kids is get them to behave and that, you know, the only thing we need to do is kind of bring order to their lives. And I think that that so diminishes what it is that children bring to school. I've worked in very, very poor communities, South Philadelphia, North Philadelphia, East Palo Alto, California, where people are just barely making it. But the hope for education in those communities is not different than the hope in middle-class communities. You know, they say the same things that middle-class people say when, you know, their kids are born. I hope he goes to college. You know, I've never, ever met a parent who wanted their kids to be a miserable failure. You
know? And this gets into this whole idea of, you know, I'm not sure if it's overt racism, but it's this sort of racial disparity. You were talking earlier about, you sort of danced around the old discredited idea of culture deficit, but mm-hmm. that's sort of what you were talking about.
Yes, yes.
And in your writings, you say this is very much pervasive in today's education and
right.
in all the political talk around
terms,
it.
Right. We don't use those terms, but we are still, the thinking that undergirds those things are still there. I share a story with people about a small island, Caribbean island nation, I think it was, under the UK, a part of the British Empire, mm-hmm. called Montserrat. And the island has a huge volcano on it. And the volcano became active. And the people of Montserrat decided, you know, we need to move off the island. The people who were on the side of the island where it was likely that the volcano was going to erupt and wipe them out. And they started talking about, well, where should we go? Well, geographically, they were closer to the United States. But because they've been a British province, they said, you know, it probably makes better sense to go to the UK because our children will be in the same school system. You know, they'll have the same, you know, the British 11-plus exams, the curriculum will be the same. So that's what they did. Well, when these families arrived in the UK, and they did settle in London, it turns out that their children were a year ahead of the children in the London schools. And the school folks said, this is a problem. So my question was, if you lag behind others and it's a problem, and if you are ahead of other people, it's a problem. It appears to me that you're just a problem. You know? and that's the example of that kind of, even when kids are doing better, there's this perception that there's a problem. We have another London example because in their early childhood program, they gave a test for their five-year-olds. And it turned out that the best performers in the city of London on this test were the little black boys across the board. Well, rather than celebrate it, what the school committee said was, there's something wrong with that test.
Oh, I knew that's what you were going to say. I was hoping you weren't. But,
you know, so...
You know, this is crazy.
Yeah, it is. It is. And so I've just been challenged by the fact that, you know, we've got old wine in new wineskins here when we're looking at what's happening with the disparities. And I've heard everyone's, you know, think, well, this group, why are we focusing on race? Why are we not doing this? Why are we not doing that? And I tell people all the time, just let's look at the data. I'm not saying that there aren't other discriminatory actions that people experience. But when we look at the data, this particular one is so predictable. I don't even have to know what city it is. You know, it just seems to play out that way everywhere we go.
And the data says?
That African-American children are performing worse than white students. The other thing is that even when you drill down and look at, because a lot of people say, well, it's social class, you know. Mm-hmm. Turns out that middle-class black children are performing worse than middle-class white children.
Upper-class African-Americans.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Worse than upper-class white
yes.
Americans.
Yeah. And, you know, you always get outliers. You always get a kid who's just, you know, got all the cultural capital and all the, you know, incredible skills. But for the most part, African-American kids, no matter what their social class, are performing at a level less than that of their white counterparts.
One of the things that you've done in some of your speeches is talk about sort of the insidious ways where we lower expectations. One is you relate a earlier example from your own classroom of labeling children as at risk.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Can you relate that story?
Yeah, this notion of at risk is sort of an interesting one because in 1983, the Commission on Excellence in Education published A Nation at Risk. And I don't know if you remember, but there was all this energy about we have to do something about this. We can't have schools like this. And the way in which that report captured the imagination, because it said the nation's at risk. It's like my debt language. That's why I say language matters. But somewhere between 1983 and today, we have been able to change that. And so now we don't talk about a nation at risk. We talk about at-risk children. So in other words, wait a minute, not everybody's at risk, just this group of kids. And so I was teaching at Santa Clara University, which is a almost exclusively white, Catholic, Jesuit, actually, institution, very widely, highly regarded. And at the time that I was teaching at Santa Clara, I think there were only 5 African-American faculty on the campus. It was a very small pool of black students. And in the 6 years I was there, I probably didn't have more than 4 or 5 black students. But I began the class in a very typical class screen, which everybody was white except me. And I began the class by saying, welcome to Introduction to Teaching in a Multicultural Society. I said, this is going to be a very tough class. It's going to be tough for you, and it's going to be tough for me because I'm not used to teaching at-risk students. Now, mind you, I started teaching at Santa Clara maybe 1984, and back then they were paying $21,000 a year for tuition. So, of course, there were people turning their heads looking to see who else was in the room because she couldn't possibly be talking about me. And I went on for about 5 or 6 minutes, and I kept referencing them as at risk. I said, I know it's a lot of reading, and I realize you're at risk, but listen, I am committed to helping you be the very best student you know how to be. So I kept inserting at risk in my discourse with them. Well, finally, somebody raised their hand, and I called on him, and I said, yes, sir. And he said, I'm deeply offended by your constant referencing us as at risk. And I said, oh, you are you? So you've been at risk all of, 5 minutes? And you're pissed off. I want you to think about what it means for people to send the most precious resource they have, their children, to you at 5 years old and get that label. And then we expect that they would be successful carrying that particular label for the next 13 years. So what we call things matters. And at risk has just been one of those terms that I've kind of purged from my vocabulary. You'll never see me writing something from me. I might quote somebody, but it won't be from me using at risk.
And yet that language is still pervasive.
Oh,
and
yeah.
It refers to class, it refers to race and ethnicity.
And what I try to remind people is that we're all at risk of something, high blood pressure, hypertension, being overweight. I mean, but that's not how we live our lives. And yet we have slotted children into these very narrow categories. And at-risk functions for poor performing students in the same way that giftedness functions for the high performers. You get constantly told how smart you are, how bright you are. I'm reading Steve Jobs, the biography that Walter Isaacson has done on it. And he said, this is a guy who, from the time he was a little boy, when he found out accidentally that he'd been adopted, he was very, very tormented by it. But when he went in and talked to his dad about it, his dad said, oh, no, you weren't given up. You were chosen. And the writer says that's the way Steve Jobs lived his life, that he was chosen. And that's why, he was probably insufferable as a manager because, who are you to speak to me that way?
Right.
I'm Steve Jobs. I'm chosen. Of course, we don't want our kids to go to that extreme. But I think when you realize that some kids have that sense of entitlement and other kids think they are so unworthy, you continue to see this disparity.
My guest today is Gloria Ladson-Billings, the Kellner Family Chair in Urban Education at the University of Wisconsin and the winner of the 2012 Brock International Prize in Education. She'll be delivering the keynote address at the Brock Symposium on Excellence in Education Thursday at 4:30 at the University of Tulsa's Lorton Performance Center. And she joins us today on Studio Tulsa. One of the things you've worked on is really you've sort of developed this language of culturally relevant pedagogy. Now, when we talk about that, you know, I can just hear that those are almost political words. And so what does culturally relevant teaching mean and what doesn't it mean?
Okay. Well, I'm glad you asked. I have this little joke that I say to my students. There's not a bunch of teachers out there with T-shirts that say, I'm a culturally relevant pedagogue. They don't exist. Until actually I went to a conference and people had made T-shirts and I was very disappointed. They're like, golly, guys. I said, please don't have a T-shirt. That term is really kind of academies that I developed to be able to talk to my colleagues to explain this incredible teaching that I was seeing with people who were doing a fabulous job with the kids that everybody said nobody can do anything with. I began researching these teachers almost 20 years ago now. In California, and I asked the question, I think what's made my work somewhat distinctive is I tried to ask the question that other people hadn't asked. The question that people keep asking is, what's wrong with these kids, and why can't anybody do anything? And I asked the question, what's right with them, and what happens in those classrooms where teachers, quote, get it right? So I didn't realize I was asking a revolutionary question, but apparently it was. And I went on a search for those teachers who do an absolute fabulous job with these kids. What I found is that what they had in common was that they didn't do the same method. They weren't like a cookie cutter. They didn't have a formula. And I think that's the thing that people can't get their heads around, because often people want to hear, just tell me what to do.
Yeah, that's what they instinctively want.
Right. But what I found among these teachers was a set of beliefs around three things. The first set of beliefs is that the focus of the classroom has to be on student learning. That no matter what else teachers do, and they do a lot, that a teacher that I would call culturally relevant has a laser-like focus on student learning. They will tell you that these youngsters should benefit from being with me. And I need to be able to show what that benefit is. The second element is what I would call cultural competence. And what I mean by cultural competence is that these are teachers who understand that kids show up at school with some assets. They don't say, oh, I have all these poor children. Oh, I have all these second language learners. Oh, I have all these immigrant children. Oh, I have all these black. They don't say that. They say that these kids come with strengths. So even if it's kindergarten, one of the things that typically kindergarten teacher would say, well, you know, the kid learned the whole language without me. You know, I wasn't there.
Right.
They have something. And it's building on that something and expanding so that kids leave with, at a minimum, they leave being, quote, bicultural. Ideally, we want all of our kids to be multicultural. But to at least be comfortable in the culture with which they came and fluent in at least another culture. Now, in the case of black kids, it's feeling like what they learn at home and among their family and friends is okay to bring in school, but that they should also leave with access to mainstream ideas and thoughts, and be able to move smoothly between the two. But it also means that white children should not leave school monolingual.
Mm.
So that's the part I think people eyebrows went up. I wasn't just talking about teaching black children. I was talking about teaching all children, but using black children as an exemplar of excellence, which almost never gets done.
Yeah. So and really celebrating all the cultures that are part of,
right,
of our country. Yeah.
Right. So culturally relevant is designed for, you know, something I want to see all teachers engage in. I don't care who the students are. That all teachers understand that kids come with cultural resources, that we build on those, and it's our job to help them extend beyond where they start so that they become more culturally versatile. Then the third element, so we started out with student learning. The second thing was cultural competence. The third element is what I would call a socio-political consciousness. And that's just a big academic phrase that means, quote, so what? And I'll give you an example. You know, typically kids say, why do we have to learn this? And most teachers don't have a good answer for that question.
Right.
The typical teacher answer, I say, comes out of Teacher Handbook 101. You're going to need this next year.
Right.
Somewhere around fourth grade, the kids figure out, you're lying. Okay, I'm not going to need this next year. Kids need to know that what they are learning is useful and powerful for improving their lives. So all three of those elements taken together are what I would call culturally relevant pedagogy, and I've seen it with very young children, and I've seen it with middle grade age students up to about sixth grade, where the teacher certainly focused on making sure the kids were performing well academically, but that the teacher pulled on the kids' culture and affirmed it in many ways, be it their language, be it home practices, and that the teacher linked up what kids were learning with their larger surroundings.
Well, we'll look forward to your keynote address at the Brock Symposium.
Thank you.
Congratulations on the Brock Prize in Education. Gloria Latson-Billings.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for joining us.
All righty. Goodbye now.
This year's Brock Laureate in Education, the winner of the Brock International Prize in Education, Gloria Latson-Billings, the Kellner Family Chair in Urban Education at the University of Wisconsin, speaking with us by phone here on Studio Tulsa. She'll be delivering the keynote address at the Brock Symposium on Excellence in Education this Thursday at 4:30 at the University of Tulsa's Lorton Performance Center. Again, that's Thursday at 4:30, and the lecture is free and open to the public. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. If you missed one of our recent shows, they're available online anytime at our new website, publicradiotulsa.org. Just click on Studio Tulsa and you can see some of our recent episodes. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.